I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. We are at T-minus 7 weeks and counting to early voting in Maryland's June primary election. Today, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates. Senator Richard S. Modolino Jr. is my guest. He's one of 9 Democrats running in the primary for governor. He has represented Montgomery County in the General Assembly for more than 15 years in the House of Delegates and since 2007 in the state Senate. He's considered a budget and tax expert and a longtime progressive thorn in the side of Governor Larry Hogan. In a year when many of his opponents are political newcomers, will his legislative experience help him prevail in the crowded primary? And if so, does he have what it takes to beat a very popular incumbent? Senator Rich Modolino joins me right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, we are continuing our series of conversations with the candidates who will be on the June 26th primary ballot here in Maryland. My guest is Senator Richard S. Modolino Jr., a Democratic candidate for governor. When he announced his candidacy last July, the list of Democrats running for governor was already long. He is now one of 9 Democrats on the ballot in June. The winner will go up against Republican Governor Larry Hogan in the general election in November. Unlike several of his Democratic opponents, Senator Modolino is not a political outsider. He has represented Montgomery County in the Maryland legislature for more than 15 years, first in the House of Delegates and since 2007 in the state Senate. Since 2015, he has been vice chair of the powerful Senate Budget and Taxation Committee. He is the first openly gay person elected to the Maryland House of Delegates and the state Senate. If elected, he would be the first openly gay governor of any state in America. His running mate is LaWanda W. Jenkins, a Baltimore native and business executive who served in the administrations of Maryland's last 3 Democratic governors, O'Malley, Glendenin, and Schaefer. Senator Modolino is 52 years old. He and his husband, Mark, live in Kensington with their 2 children. We are streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page. We will begin taking your questions and comments a little bit later in our program. Senator, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here with you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure as well. So let's start by talking about the profession of politics. Mm-hmm. The current incumbent ran in his primary 4 years ago, partially on the fact that he was an outsider. He had never held political office. He beat the former county executive of Harford County handily. He ran in the general election against the current, at that time, the lieutenant governor, partially making the pitch that as an outsider, as a common sense business person, he was the best choice. And he beat, now Congressman Brown by 66,000 votes. Mm-hmm. Has the mood of the electorate changed much in the last 4 years when it comes to this notion of career politicians? Because now for some time in American elections, it's been, it's been a slam on people who have devoted their life to public service and elective office. How do you think the mood is these days? And as a person who served in the legislature for 15 years, how that positions you in this race?
Well, I would like to try to correct the record about one thing about Larry Hogan. Larry Hogan has spent his adult life trying to be a career elected official. I mean, Larry Hogan ran for Congress in 1989 the first time. He ran several times for office and lost. So the one big difference between he and I, for example, is I've won my elections before running for governor. So this whole nice sort of myth of he was a simple businessman who ran for office. He is from Maryland's most prominent Republican family of the last century. His father was a county executive, a congressman. His brother was a member of the House of Delegates. No stranger to politics. He has spent his adult life engaged in politics, and good for him. I mean, that is a noble thing to do, but I don't think the voters of Maryland should see him as, the simple outsider businessman who one day just had enough and ran for office. He's been very heavily engaged, even so much, and some of your listeners may find this both interesting and humorous. This is how far back he goes into in politics. Mike Miller, the president of the state Senate, was his babysitter. I mean, that, literally, as a child, Mike Miller was one of his babysitters. So that is how far back he is intertwined in Prince George's and Maryland politics.
Yeah, fair enough. But, but you would acknowledge that there is this thing. I mean, Mr. Trump, you know, our current president, ran on a similar platform. That, you know, that somehow politics is a dirty, you know, a dirty field, and that anybody who's been in it for any period of time is immediately suspect.
Mm-hmm. You know, that is a regular commentary on people who have decided to spend time and effort in public service and trying to make their community better, running for various levels of office to try to work hard in that regard. So I'm proud of that. And, you know, when you went through a little bit about my bio and the fact that I was the first openly gay person elected in 2002, when I first decided to run, I was counseled by many people, like, stay in the closet. You'll never succeed. You'll never get elected. And here we are, not long after, we have so changed.
That climate is totally different.
Yeah. That now it's like, oh, ho-hum. Yeah, he's a gay person running for governor. Yeah.
Thank you, Supreme Court.
So I love the fact. I wear it as a badge of honor that people say, they'll try to dismiss me as just part of the establishment when I was rocking the boat when I walked in. And so I think it says a lot about Maryland, the political culture of Maryland, the civic culture of Maryland, that we so quickly adapt and bring a wider and wider circle of people engaged to the process. Look, I think knowing something about the level of government that you're seeking to lead, having been engaged in the tough decisions about policy, about the budget, about a variety of topics over time, has made me the better prepared, if not the best prepared in this field, to take on this responsibility. Having people from the outside, I mean, to me, I think you see the implications and the challenges of that with Donald Trump. Without the relationships, without the experience, you get to see what sort of person you get to see what challenges someone like that has. And in these difficult times, when there are serious issues, when we have to think long term for how we position our state for the future, having a novice to state government in this role, I don't think is the right move for the people of the state of Maryland.
In terms of moving from the legislative side, should you be elected, to the executive side, I think, for example, about the fight for $15, the $15 mm-hmm. minimum wage. You were involved in a minimum wage fight back when it was $10.10. You know, mm-hmm. Now
$7.25 to get it. To get it to ten ten.
So now the fight is, you know, the $15 minimum wage, which would be gradually phased in until 2023. The fight for $15 began what, 2014, 15 or something. It failed again this past session in 2018. Mm-hmm. In terms of moving legislation like that. You haven't had much luck with that particular bill over these last 4 or 5 years. What can you do differently as the governor to move the needle, for example, in that particular area?
Sure. It's only been the last 2 years that the bill has been in to try to move us to 15. And, you know, I was one of the people in the fight for 10-10 who was advocating for the bill as it was initially introduced had an inflationary index built into it. And if my colleagues had just listened then, you know, maybe we would be in a different position than fighting to keep it going up to 15.
So if you're governor, how do you get your colleagues to listen now? That's kind of the question.
Yeah. Here's the interesting thing about being governor, and I don't know if people realize this or too many of your listeners realize this. The governor of Maryland is the most powerful governor in the country. Our state constitution reserves more powers to our governor than any other state. Most extreme budgetary authority. The legislature can only reduce the budget once the governor proposes it. Appoints everybody except for the elected comptroller and attorney general. Everyone else in state government appointed by the governor. All of the judges from the district court to the appellate courts, all appointed by the judges. The state school board, several of the local school boards. All the regulations for state government are promulgated by the governor and the executive branch, and the legislature can only hold hearings on it and comment. But the only way to change a regulation is to pass a law that overrides it, that, of course, the governor can veto. It's used that because of those powers, the governor has an unparalleled ability to set the agenda, to pull people along, to have a bully pulpit, to be a cheerleader for these sorts of changes. I mean, we haven't seen Larry Hogan do those things because, quite frankly, I don't think he's interested in some of these public policies. I want to use the authority of the office to do those things, to make progress for the working families of the state, to make sure they have access to jobs that pay them a wage that they can support themselves, because no one working full time should be living in poverty, making sure that people have health care, people have access to the social safety net, good transportation, a world-class public school system. Those things we can do in Maryland if you have a governor who's committed to doing it and using those authorities to get, using the authority of the office, using the powers of the office to get other people to come along in the legislature, at local government, in the business community. It is an unbelievable opportunity to bring change to Maryland.
Right now, of course, you're not running against Mr. Hogan. You're running against six other major candidates in this race, all of whom bring various levels of expertise and experience, some in the federal government, some in the nonprofit sector, some in the activist community. So Democratic voters have to make a decision who they want to put up against a very popular incumbent governor, in Mr. Hogan. So before we talk about Mr. Hogan, how do you distinguish yourself from this very crowded and people would also say very impressive field of candidates?
Well, it is a very impressive field. Tremendous resumes, people who've accomplished a lot in their lives and made positive impacts on the state, on the country. I think you have so many quality people running because they sense the opportunity to win, that for as much as the polls might show the governor is popular, he's quite vulnerable. We're walking into a blue wave election. So this is an exciting opportunity to put Maryland back on a Democratic path. That being said, I believe I'm the best candidate. I have the best opportunity to be the successful governor, the best opportunity to defeat Larry Hogan, because no one has my level of experience, my record of accomplishment at the state level. In your introduction of me, you talked about my role in the budget. Probably if you were to talk to people in Annapolis, and my reputation is I'm the budget guy. I'm the person year in and year out who's tasked with putting the budget together, making sure it's balanced, making sure we're getting at the issues that the public cares about, trying to, over the last several years, rebalance where Governor Hogan is going on these issues. So no one in this field has my, again, record of accomplishments and experience and working on issues that are important for all the people of the state of Maryland. Last year, there was a big rally in Baltimore City, in Annapolis, for the Baltimore City schools. I was the one non-city official who was asked to address that crowd because of my longstanding commitment and work on issues of trying to improve the Baltimore City public schools. I go back from my early days outside of college when I worked for Pete Rawlings and, interestingly, Maggie McIntosh as a junior
who's the head
staff,
of the
who's now the chair of the Appropriations
in
Committee.
In the House, right.
So I have deep connections to the city. So I know I've been a Montgomery County legislator, but that has not made me work any less for the young people of the city or the young people of our entire state. And so that's what differentiates myself from everyone else. I joke that last night we had a forum in Baltimore that was sponsored by the Sierra Club and the League of Conservation Voters. I have a 93% lifetime score on environmental issues. And I was talking to a reporter and I said, 93% lifetime score. I'm the only one with a score. And the reporter said, oh, you mean you've got the highest score? And I'm like, no, I'm the only one with a score because I'm the only one who's been working on these issues. It's great that you want to say, I want to do X, Y, and Z for the people of the state of Maryland. But for several of these candidates, they've never voted in a Maryland primary before. We have two candidates who have never cast a vote in a Maryland Democratic primary before.
But for example, a County Executive Kamenetz or County Executive Baker would say, would make a similar pitch to voters.
Yes,
right? That
yes,
they've run stuff before.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they would say you've been a legislator, you've not been an executive, you haven't run stuff the way they've run stuff.
And I think local governments are very are fundamentally different than the state government. When you look at the transition that both Martin O'Malley and William Donald Schaefer had to being governor of Maryland, there's a hands-on there's a hands-on operation and management as mayor that when you become governor, it's a totally different situation. I understand how and where how state government works. What are the functions we're doing? I've been involved in a variety of ways over 30 years in making those decisions. Having that institutional knowledge to make those decisions with that background is something that I think I have in an unparalleled way in this race, even though, no question, County Executive Kamenetz, County Executive Baker are accomplished individuals and public servants in their own right.
Senator Rich Modolino, he has represented District 18 in the Maryland Senate since 2007. Before that, he represented parts of Montgomery County in Maryland's House of Delegates. He is one of nine Democrats running in the June primary for the chance to face Republican Governor Larry Hogan in the general election in November. We will have more with Senator Rich Modolino when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780 is how to join our conversations with questions for the senator. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to find us on Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. And again, we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It is indeed midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on our program, we're going to take a look at the latest plans for redevelopment in Harbor East, which includes the potential loss of public housing that is adjacent to that neighborhood. Baltimore Business Journal reporter Melody Simmons and urban planner Klaus Phillipson are going to join me for that. Plus, social justice activist Brittany Oliver will tell us more about her organization, Not Without Black Women. That's coming up Monday on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Senator Rich Modolino. He is one of nine candidates running in the June primary to be the Democratic nominee for governor. And by the way, you can hear all of our conversations with the candidates at WIPR.org/midday. You are welcome to be part of our conversation with Senator Modolino at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Senator, we have a couple of tweets and some emails concerning the issue of a proposal to require presidential and vice presidential candidates to release their tax returns. You have released your tax returns for the last 6 years. To my knowledge, you are the only one of the candidates in the primary to have done that. But a couple of folks are asking about why you voted against the proposal to have to make that same requirement of elected officials in Maryland, people in the House, people in the Senate, and people in the leadership.
Sure. There was a legislation this year to require candidates for president of the United States to release their tax returns in order to qualify for the Maryland ballot. Donald Trump was the first candidate in decades who did not voluntarily release his tax returns. And I think there are a lot of questions, a lot of concerns. I know a lot of Americans are concerned about what is his exposure? Is he double dealing? Is he taking profits from being president? We don't know those things because we don't know that information about him. So believing that was important, I was part of the team that moved that bill through the Senate. As part of the deliberations, an amendment came up saying everyone should release their tax returns. That was overly broad. If it had been just governor, I would have voted yes for that amendment. How about this, though? Just because it's not in the law doesn't mean it's not the right thing to do, which is why I've released my 6 years of federal and state tax returns so that people can see my life, my economic life, and have a degree of confidence about whether or not I have conflicts of interest as being governor. And that's why I want and said I think everyone in this race, including Larry Hogan, should do that. Because,
but specifically, then why doesn't it belong as a matter of statute? I mean, if it is the right thing to do, if people are do aspire rightly to a level of transparency in government, why shouldn't voters have an idea of how much money people are making, where that money comes from? If it's good enough for Mr. Trump, why isn't it good enough for senators from Montgomery County?
I do think there is a difference between being a legislator and being the executive. I think that's, we can start doing the right thing voluntarily. I mean, the funny part is I've done this. I've released the tax returns, and somehow I'm getting attacked for not making it a legal requirement. Okay, that's all released tax returns. I don't know why people are balking at doing the right thing, because it's not the law. Is that how jaundiced we've become as Marylanders, as Americans, that you don't want to do the right thing? You only do the right thing if it's the law? This is the right thing for people aspiring to this type of office, the high executive office, president, governor. I don't know if every local commissioner needs to do it. And quite frankly, I don't think every member of the legislature needs to do it. There are extensive ethics forms that you have to file. But for this type of conflict, I think risk of conflict of interest, it makes sense doing this. And I would let your listeners know, if they hadn't seen the report in the online news source, Maryland Matters, which is
one publication.
Yes.
Josh Kurtz started that last year.
Right. So Maryland Matters had an enormous article about all of the potential conflicts of interest that Larry Hogan has. Through all of his extensive real estate holdings, and the fact that he's never put his business in a trust, he's turned over the operation of his business to one of his brothers, but he is still benefiting from that. And as a real estate developer in the state of Maryland, there are all sorts of decisions that are happening in government. Shouldn't we know if he in fact is profiting from his role as governor of the state of Maryland, which is why I think he should release his tax returns, because the state ethics forms don't provide that level of detail. And he got an extensive waiver from the Ethics Commission. We should know that information, and we should know that information about the other people who are seeking to hold this office, which is why I led on this effort and said, I'll release my returns, let's see from everyone else. No one else has done it yet.
Rich Modolino is running for governor in the Democratic primary. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to find us on Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. By the way, if you want to follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWIPR. And you can also see what's cooking here in Studio A right now on the WIPR Facebook page, where we are streaming. Let's go to the phone. Senator, you have a couple of calls here. Paul in Severna Park, welcome to Midday with Senator Modolino.
It is a pleasure to have a chance to ask a couple of questions. I'm a registered Democrat from Severna Park, but I am very unhappy with the state Democratic Party. My two major complaints are gerrymandering. It turns out that according to Zavea, a cartography firm in the Philadelphia area, that Maryland is the congressional districts are the worst gerrymandered in the whole country. It turns out that in Anne Arundel County, it's been broken up into four congressional districts, and none of our congressmen live in Anne Arundel County.
Okay, well, Paul, I appreciate the call. We get the gist of your question, and I appreciate it. And forgive me for cutting you short, but we do have a lot of issues to cover. So, Senator, the governor has proposed a redistricting commission. The legislature, including yourself, if I'm correct, was not for that idea, preferring to have a situation where several states, you know, adjacent to Maryland, all agree to establish commissions to establish districts. I mean, Paul is absolutely right when it comes to the level of gerrymandering that happened under a Democratic administration the last time around.
So in 2003, when I was first elected to the House of Delegates, I put in a constitutional amendment to have a nonpartisan commission to do redistricting after the 2000 round of redistricting and the feelings that people had about the gerrymandering then, I have believed that there was a more appropriate way for us to do this. As governor, if given that honor, you have the upper hand to do it. Let's face it, though. While you can complain about—
But you do it without Pennsylvania, Virginia,
well, it would be very— Well, here's the problem. You look at the New York Times article that showed the most gerrymandered states in the country. We're there with 17 states that were gerrymandered by the Republicans to give them an advantage. So you can point to Maryland and say there's a degree of frustration, and I get it, and I share it. But this is a major problem that has been driven by big money on the right with the Republican Party. I hope the Supreme Court, which has a case from Maryland, from Wisconsin, they're sitting in
Maryland
front of them,
and Wisconsin,
that,
right.
they give some guidance to us about how we move forward with standards around redistricting. I have to say, we can't use as a gauge of whether or not a good district looks good, that it's a fair district because it looks good. We're always going to have unusual looking districts in Maryland because we have a beautiful and unique looking state to begin with. So we have to move beyond the look, but we have to ensure that there's fairness. And I think it got out of hand 4 years ago. The last time around, there's no question. And
this will be, given the fact that the next redistricting is going to happen in just about a year and a half, this will be top of mind in the legislature in January of 19.
Well, it'll happen in 2021. You know,
right.
Because the census has to occur in 20, and then you got to have the data and then move forward. So this is an issue that will pop up during
the year 21,
but it will be during the next term of whoever's governor. So, you know, I'd love to see this is a national problem.
But you wouldn't support a commission only for Maryland at this juncture.
Oh, I'm saying I did. I'm the only one with legislation that did it and tried to do it. And certainly as governor, I would seek to do that, to have fair districts, because, you know, one of the downsides, and everyone says, oh, we shouldn't have politicians pick their voters. The voters are supposed to pick their politicians. Well, because we have districts like this all over the country, it's made it easy because one party has the advantage in each district. The result is people stop trying. Right.
And so you would push for a commission.
I would.
Independent commission.
Yes.
And
yes. And we've always had a commission.
Regardless of whether or not the other states go along.
You realize we've always had commissions.
Right.
But, we should
sort of California-esque system.
We should move in that direction to make sure that people feel positive about it. But the outcome, I mean, there are people in states where they have commissions. There are plenty of people in California who complain about the way the districts are in California.
Sure.
The Republican Party sued to overturn the nonpartisan commission in California, saying it disadvantaged them. And that was a group of retired judges. So
right.
That, don't think these problems magically go away.
All right, let's hit on a couple of other issues. We have a tweet, I guess, from Catherine, who says, I've been trying to learn more about Mr. Modolino since he's at the top of my list for governor. One question, what does he do during the rest of the year when the Maryland Senate is not in session? What is your occupation?
So I have had the unique good fortune of getting to be a stay-at-home dad So I was first elected in 2002, started serving in 2003, and our first child was born in the summer of 2003. And my husband and I made the decision, for me, if I went back to work at that point, we would just take all of my income to pay someone else to care for this child that we spent all this time and
effort. So you're a full-time senator.
So I've been a full-time senator and a full-time dad, and giving me that added opportunity to get the kids through their early years, and now we're about to finish our last year of elementary school in our household. And so
it's a 14-year-old and an
11-year-old.
Yeah, yeah.
So it'll be a good opportunity for us all to have a big change in our lives.
So I hear you're looking for a job. Yeah. Right?
Yes.
Which is why we're here. David in Gambrills, welcome to Midday with Senator Modolino.
Hello. I just have a question. Mr. Modolino's expertise in budgetary matters, what are his plans with respect to Maryland's structural deficit, something that Governor Glenn Denning have complained about, where there's just, you know, built-in system where there's just a lack of money for other for necessary items in the budget.
All right, thanks for that call, David. Appreciate it.
Thank you, David. And it's one of my favorite topics to talk about because the Maryland structural deficit is entirely an artificial problem that we have created for ourselves. Do you know what the, Tom, do you know what the structural deficit is for the state of Virginia?
I have no idea.
Would you be surprised if I said they don't have one?
Probably. I'm surprised when I hear anybody doesn't have a deficit.
Exactly, because the state of Virginia has no law that requires them to report on any out-year estimate beyond 1 year. So we have, in the spirit of transparency, we have set up this process where we say we want to look 6 years into the future of where our revenue is going and where our spending patterns going. And we're going to budget every concept. You know, we're going to make sure every employee gets a 2% pay increase for each one of those years. And every employee gets their step increase for every one of those years. And then at the end of the term, at the end of the 6 years, you know, you've got a $1 billion structural deficit. Well,
so you're saying that it's folly to try to predict that far ahead?
The only thing I can guarantee you with almost 100% certainty is it's all wrong. Because who knows in 6 years? When we were sitting in 2007, I'll give you a wonderful impression example of this. In 2007, there was a special session under the O'Malley administration to try to fix our revenue structure, our structural deficit. By the time we were done that special session, all of the numbers were in the black. We're completely balanced for 6 years in the future. That was Thanksgiving of 2007. A recession started.
Yeah, and then 2008
came. Two weeks later, and it all changed. You have no idea what is around the corner in 12 months, let alone 6 years. The whole idea is it's a guidepost to be able to say, all right, here's an idea of where we're going. Is our tax structure adequate? What does our spending look like? What are our trends like for how many kids are going to be in K-12? How many kids are going to be higher education? Those are important things to think about and to have when you're having this conversation. But I don't know anyone who thinks ahead of, you know, oh my God, how am I going to pay for Christmas, for the Christmas gifts for Christmas 2024.
Right.
That's not.
So, would you support a constitutional or legislative fix to the process by which these structural deficits are determined?
Well, I do think I have long chatted with people about how we take out some of the artificial planned growth in the budget that factors into the structural deficit. The whole idea of when we're factoring out your spending, we're going to budget every single penny of every pay increase for the next 6 years. I mean, it's great that we have this aspiration. We're going to give every employee a pay increase every year for the next 6 years. But that compounds year after year. If you're doing 2% plus 2%, that all compounds. You do that. You don't do that 1 year, and that all goes away. So it's one of those things that I find incredibly frustrating. And I give Larry Hogan credit. He has demagogued this issue and confused the voters about what this means. I mean, in the end, right now, even 6 years out, from a structural budget deficit, we're only off by like 5 or 6%. So it's not an extreme, even though it's a big sounding dollar amount, because every time you go over $1 billion, To the average person, that sounds like a lot of money.
A billion here, a billion there. All of a sudden, you're talking about real money.
No, that's the federal government. Yes. That's not the.
We're going to take a little break, and we will try to do what we can to attenuate any confusion among the voters when we come back. Senator Rich Modolino is a Democratic candidate running for governor. His running mate is Lawanda Jenkins, a Baltimore native and business executive who served in the last three Democratic gubernatorial administrations. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. Ginger Baker playing in the background. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we are continuing our series of conversations with the candidates today with Senator Rich Modolino. He's represented parts of Montgomery County in the Maryland legislature for the past 15 years. He was in the House of Delegates for 4 years and elected to the Senate 11 years ago. He's the vice chair of the Senate Budget and Taxation Committee. He is one of 9 Democrats running for governor of Maryland. His opponents in the June primary include Krish Vignaraja, Rashorn Baker, Kevin Kamenetz, Ben Jealous, Alec Ross, Jim Shea, and 2 others. If you have questions for Senator Modolino, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. On Twitter, @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. Senator, you've called for debt-free education. Some of your opponents in the race have called for free community college. There are some jurisdictions like Baltimore, I think maybe Montgomery County, who already offer free community college to residents there that meet a certain income plateau. What do you mean by debt-free education, and how does that proposal differ from people who say, let's make community college, or even in some cases, all of college free for constituents?
Right. And believe it or not, Garrett County in far western Maryland was the first jurisdiction to move forward with free community college. This year, I led the charge to get a bill through the Senate that unfortunately didn't make it through the House to have free community college for every Maryland high school student. We even included in that the opportunity to have everyone get a chance to do a free job certification program through a community college. So even if you don't want to go for an associate's degree, but you want to be a certified electrician, or a plumber, a computer coder, whatever, that you would have that opportunity. Debt-free higher education means that you can get that 4-year degree without having to borrow. When you look at the results of the experience around the country, it's not bad for young people, for their families, to make a contribution towards their degree. And if a family can, and the proposals we've put out there show, you know, for families making over $150,000 a year, they'd have to make a contribution. That, to me, that is fair moving forward from a progressive standpoint, not to say that it's free and free for everybody. Certainly for the concept of the community college would be give everyone the opportunity to get access to a free associate's degree or job training certificate, and then moving forward into the 4-year institutions that people would have a chance to get through without debt, but that doesn't mean without a financial contribution.
Let's talk about issues that are particularly appropriate and of great concern to people here in Baltimore and Central Maryland. One has to do with violence reduction. There are a number of crime bill proposals that were introduced, some failed, some passed in this past session. One of them was known as SB 122, called the Omnibus Crime Bill. Bobby Zirkin, a Democrat from Baltimore County, and Larry Hogan both supported it. You voted for that version in the Senate. That version did not pass. Ultimately, what did pass were 2 components of it. One of those components funds Safe Streets, a violence interdiction program that's has shown some success here in Baltimore. The other does have a certain modicum of minimum sentences and mandatory minimums that would take the power away from judges and put it into the statutory record. And there are, speaking of progressives, and you've been known as a progressive your entire political career, and a number of people on the left who take great issue with that approach to violence reduction. The bill that did pass was sponsored by Senator Branch, Talmadge Branch, who's an African-American, well aware of the fact that mandatory minimums tend to disproportionately affect people of color as opposed to other folks. So as a political philosophy, is mandatory minimums the only way that we can address violence reduction? And the bill that passed, by the way, we should say, concerned felons with multiple convictions, more than one conviction for committing crimes with a handgun.
So there's tremendous, I think, confusion over what worked through the legislative process and then what passed. The Senate Bill 122, the comprehensive bill that passed the Senate initially, it included a whole range of funding for the Safe Streets program, a whole series of violence prevention programs, for diversion programs, for pretrial services to make sure people don't wind up in jail. It was a very comprehensive look at, in fact, the most extensive one that we had done to really push forward with the whole idea of criminal justice reform and actually reducing the number of people being incarcerated, reducing, giving people more opportunities for expungements, including expungements of felony drug convictions, so that that would get off people's records. Now, that bill included some longer sentences, so it enhanced the maximum sentences. And the only mandatory minimums that were included in that bill, actually the increase in the sentence could be waived by a judge, depending upon their discretion. So while it was a mandatory minimum of, let's say, 10 years, going from 5 to 10 in each and every case, that extra 5 years could be suspended by the judge at their discretion. That compromise, I thought, was worth moving forward with because of the idea of that you're talking about second offenders for violent crimes, rape, assaults, crimes with the use of a firearm. The number of people who would have been subjected to enhanced sentences as a result of this was estimated to be around 200. 200 of the most violent repeat offenders. Now, that's the bill that moved through the Senate that people are upset about. The bill that came back from the House, which you mentioned was sponsored by Delegate Branch, who is himself, his family, the victim of a murder in the city over the last year.
His grandchild
was killed. That bill had hard minimum mandatory sentences. A number of us said, no, that's not what we were talking about. That goes too far. That is setting the conditions for mass incarceration. It is taking discretion away from judges. It is putting just more people behind bars who don't necessarily belong there. So I voted against that measure. A whole number of us voted against that measure. So it
which did ultimately pass.
That did pass, and it's pending before the governor. Now, fortunately, the House decided to move a series of initiatives, including the one that fully funds the Safe Streets program. And you know, Senator Joan Carter Conway advocated for that. Senator McFadden advocated for that. Delegate Brooke Learman, it's her bill that in the end passed. The pretrial release program and funding for pretrial services was sponsored by Delegate Eric Barron outside of Prince George's County. So there were plenty of us who believe in criminal justice reform and putting real resources behind criminal justice reform in order to keep people out of jail and to reduce violence. You know, this year, the state, for the conversation about the structural deficit, this year, the state has a pretty hefty surplus. Part of that is because of the crazy tax scam that was passed by the Republicans on Capitol Hill, but it wound up giving us a sizable extra amount of money. I proposed putting part of that money into pretrial services so that we could help keep people out of jail, and doing that sort of upfront investment in some of these diversion programs and violence prevention programs that save more money in the future, because you know it's wise if you have this, and we don't know how long this is going to last, that you take some of this money and invest it in things that could save money in the long run.
Was it a good idea then to also pass legislation that shelters Maryland taxpayers from who would be paying more under the Republican tax plan, about 90% of those folks, by way of manipulating how our tax code is aligned with the federal government tax code? The governor and many Democrats, Mr. Bush, Mr. Miller, very proud of the fact that a good chunk of that money that would have cost so many more Marylanders more money under the so-called tax cut law, was it a good idea to essentially give back to 91% of Marylanders that money?
Well, we didn't do that. I mean, the the way that the tax bill works out at the federal level, the vast majority of Marylanders will see no change in their tax bill for Maryland. Some will see it go down, and an estimated 9% of Maryland taxpayers will see their combined federal, state, and local taxes be higher in 2018 than 2017. We decided that the overwhelming number of people who are in that group are amongst the wealthiest people in the state, people who have a series of miscellaneous deductions or business losses. And for all of the business losses that you used to be able to claim all in 1 year, the federal law now makes you smooth that out over a number of years. You still get to claim every penny of those losses. So over a 3-year period, you're not going to pay any more in taxes, but over a 1-year period, you are. To me, it didn't make sense to say, "Oh, we've got to fix this."
Let's shield them
for what happened. And this is another example of where Larry Hogan loves to play politics with the people of the state of Maryland. His Republican Party moved forward with the most extreme rewrite of federal tax law in a generation, done without any public hearings, done without any fiscal estimates, done where we all noticed, literally, they were handwriting changes in the bill at midnight in order to get the votes. And his idea of good governance is for us to go along with that, to enact all of that into our law. That was irresponsible. It was not transparent. It was not fair. And I'm glad we said no to that. Let's take a step back and try to understand how this is all going to happen. Because, you know, one misplaced comma in one of those handwritten sections could result in billions of loopholes.
Let me ask you another question about taxes. That we get a tweet from Red Maryland, which is an organization that advocates for Republican candidates.
They love me.
Yeah, they do indeed. In this tweet, like every other Democratic candidate, you would drastically raise state spending and then tax working Marylanders into poverty. The typical description of the tax and spend liberal. Again, you've got a governor with an 80%, 85% approval rating in certain counties in this state. I mean, how do you assuage people's fears that your political philosophy would put us into the poorhouse?
I love being lectured by a Republican in 2018 about fiscal responsibility. I mean, their party, after years of complaining about bad behavior, about irresponsible spending, they have run up the biggest peacetime deficit. So the Republican Party, Larry Hogan, Donald Trump, they have absolutely no credibility about moving forward. It has been Democrats who have delivered real services and real progress for the state of Maryland. And if you want that to continue, you want Rich Mattolino as governor.
All right. There are some other comments on the WIPR Facebook page that you can listen to and take a look at and perhaps choose to respond directly to those listeners. Senator, I appreciate your coming by. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom, very much for having me.
Senator Rich Mattolino, he has represented parts of Montgomery County in the Maryland legislature for the past 15 years, both in the House and the Senate. He's vice chair of the Senate Budget and Taxation Committee. He is one of 9 Democrats running in the June primary for governor. We've got a link to Rich Mattolino's campaign website at WIPR.org/midday. Early voting in the June primary begins in 54 days. It starts on Flag Day, June 14th. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, reporter Melody Simmons and urban planner Klaus Philipson join me for a conversation about a proposal for a huge redevelopment project, which includes the potential loss of public housing just north of Harbor East here in Baltimore. Plus, activist Brittany Oliver will tell us about her organization, Not Without Black Women. She'll be appearing at the Women of the World Festival next weekend, and she'll be with us midday on Monday. Thanks to Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small patch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, specialty cream cheeses, inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s, available at the Waverly and JFX Farmers Markets and online at bottomsupbagels.com.
Bakery.com. We want to thank also Patango Bakery and Cafe for providing lunch. They're located on South Ann Street in historic Fells Point. They specialize in imported Italian charcuterie and house-made breads and pastries. They're open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. with menu and hours on their website, patangogelato.com/bakery. Midday's director and engineers Luke Spicknall, Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, Kathleen Cahill, Jamila Kremple, and Austin Coughlin are also important members of the team. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.